So Saba told me that lots of you wanted to discuss cosmological perturbation theory. That's a topic that I had planned to skip because it's quite technical, but if there's interest, I am happy to go through it. So this will take a while though, because there's like lots of groundwork to be laid. Okay, so yeah, so right, so then today what we'll do is to start laying the groundwork. This is gonna take a bunch of lectures. So for this, I'm gonna follow Dodelson mostly, that book I mentioned before. So then I would highly recommend getting this book. If you guys don't know where to get it, just let me know and I can point you to places to get it.
Is this the same one you showed at the beginning of the
That's right. That's right. That's
who's
right. But now there's like a more modern version than my version.
Not that one. Oh yeah, that one's lecture notes. That one's
Yeah, so Daniel Bauman also has lecture notes. I don't know if his notation matches what I'll be doing. But again, well, notation can be different. The physics is pretty much the same. Okay, so just to remind you, so far we've been doing, a homogeneous isotropic FRW universe, right? So we had described that homogeneous isotropic universe with some metric, g mu nu. And our assumption so far was that this metric depends on time, but not on spatial location x. We also had contents within the universe. You know, those contents were described by a distribution function, and also then moments of the distribution function, like the density, the pressure, and so on. And again, so far we've been assuming that these are all functions of time, but not functions of location. And so now what we'll do is to allow for spatial dependence as well for all of these, for the metric, the matter contents, the distribution function, everything. So what we'll do is to treat this as an initial value problem. Okay, so we'll be specifying initial conditions for the metric and also for the distribution function, and then we will evolve them over time. Now, in general, this time evolution in general is quite hard, okay? Because, for example, the matter fluctuations, so these delta rho's, these matter fluctuations by Einstein's equations, they can generate metric fluctuations, right? And similarly, metric fluctuations, they can source matter fluctuations. So, for example, things like gravitational instability can occur, okay, right? And so in general, we have this feedback loop where these, where these spatial fluctuations in the matter fields and in the metric, they can source each other, okay? And so, solving for this in general is a complicated problem, solved most generally by doing numerical simulations, okay? So relativity simulations. But if these fluctuations are small, then we can use perturbation theory to solve for the time evolution of everything. Okay, and luckily for us, we do indeed observe on the actual universe, okay, that the actual fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, for example, are indeed really tiny. Okay, so therefore, doing perturbation theory is sensible. Okay, so if we write more generally the density, let's say rho, as a function of x and t, right, so we can write this as, as some unperturbed density, rho of t, plus some perturbation delta rho of xt, or equivalently, we can write this as rho of t times what's called 1 plus the over density. Okay, and so all I mean just is that the regime that we'll be working in is where this delta is very small compared to 1. Okay. Similarly, we'll also have metric fluctuations, these delta g mu nu's. So generally we can write g mu nu of x and t as our unperturbed FRW metric plus some delta g mu nu. Okay, and then similarly, the assumption will be that this delta g mu nu is small compared to the FRW metric. So to remind you, our unperturbed metric took the form ds squared was minus dt squared plus a squared dr squared plus d squared of r d omega squared. Okay, Now, as I mentioned before, observationally, the limits on the spatial curvature are now incredibly tight, okay? And so therefore, just to make things simpler for myself from now on, I'll be assuming that the mean spatial curvature vanishes, okay? So from now on, so what that means is that, I'm at this d squared of r is just r squared, which is just the normal Euclidean metric, okay? So from now on, I'll just.
Is it the mean curvature? Like, we're assuming you're putting the metric at every point it will do R2, so it's not like really, how is it the mean curvature?
Well, right, because very soon we're going to add fluctuations around that mean, right? Uh-huh. Okay, so locally there will be space curvature. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying though is that our unperturbed universe, I will assume to have locally. I mean, globally, no average curvature, okay? So therefore, our unperturbed metric, just will be the normal, spatial Euclidean metric, okay? So we can write this as minus dt squared plus a squared delta ij dxi dxj, okay? Where again, this delta ij means, it just means the Euclidean metric. And so for Cartesian coordinates, the delta ij is just the Kronecker delta. Okay, next what I'll also do is to change time coordinates from this like normal, like physical or proper time to what's called conformal time. Okay, so the conformal time is defined by d eta is dt over a, all right? Changing to this eta coordinates, then our metric becomes ds squared is minus, or well, it's a squared minus dt squared minus d eta squared plus delta ij. Okay, so good. This is our unperturbed metric. So now let's consider some completely general perturbation to the metric. Okay, and so instead of this g mu nu, we'll have some g mu nu plus some small perturbation h mu nu. Okay, so since the metric tensor is symmetric, then this perturbation h mu nu, a four-dimensional tensor. So since it's symmetric, it'll have 10 degrees of freedom, right? Everyone see that? Okay. So we can most generally write it in the following form. Okay, so it'll be a small change to this. So we can most generally write this as a squared of eta times minus 1 plus a d eta squared minus 2 bi d eta dxi plus delta ij plus hij dxi dxj. Okay, so this a is some spatial scalar, this b is some spatial vector, this hij is some 3x3 spatial tensor, okay? So this A has 1 degree of freedom, this B has 3 degrees of freedom, this has 6 degrees of freedom, and so in total we have still 10 degrees of freedom in our perturbation, okay? And of course, don't forget that all these H, B, and A, they're all functions of X and T, space and time, okay? So now what we'll do is to decompose these, this A, B, and H, into scalar, vector, and tensor degrees of freedom. So the reason for doing this decomposition, okay, is that, so we'll see later on, that the evolution equations for the scalars, they will decouple from the evolution equations for the vectors and the tensors and so on. Okay. So what we'll do is to decompose A, B, and H into scalar, vector, and tensor degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Like even for hyperbolic and curved space terms, this metric is true in Cartesian coordinates?
Even, sorry, say it again.
Like for k, for non-zero values of k.
Yeah, so for non-zero, then we have this d, you know, as that function that we wrote down before, right? You know that cinch of r over some curvature scale, you know, right?
But in Cartesian coordinates, this is always true. If they don't work in radial coordinates.
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
The metric that you have written, that's mm-hmm. true only for Planck space, or is it in general?
So here, delta, yeah, means the flat space Euclidean metric, yeah.
So k is zero.
Yeah, flat space, I said, right. Okay, sorry, okay, yeah, so just, yeah, okay, right, yeah. So just to reiterate, okay, so because the observational limits on the mean curvature, the mean spatial curvature for our universe are so tight, from now on I will be assuming that the mean curvature vanishes, which means that therefore we can describe, you know, the mean universe as this spatially flat FRW metric, in which the spatial part of the metric is just Euclidean with this overall scale factor, right? Yeah.
And that h I j there, the like the coefficient of dx I dx j is just the traceless part of the perturbation. Is it like?
We're getting to this. Very good. Yeah.
Okay, but it's not like, I mean, the full perturbation metric is 1 plus a, b, and hij together. So this hij is not the somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So over here, when I said h mu nu, that was, yeah, very general.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, yeah, right. Yeah, so, yeah. So yeah. There will be lots and lots of repeated uses of the same letters. Don't worry about it for now. Okay. Right. Okay. Good. Good. So now what we'll do is to decompose this very general metric perturbation into scalar, vector, and tensor degrees of freedom. Okay. So naively, you might think that okay, look. So this A is a scalar, so therefore we have one scalar degree of freedom. This B is a vector, so we have three vector degrees of freedom. H is a tensor, so we have six tensor degrees of freedom. Okay. But that isn't quite correct. We can actually decompose these even further into scalar vectors and tensors. So what I mean by this is the following. Okay, so for example, consider this vector b, right? So in general, we can write this vector b as the sum of a gradient of some of some scalar function. Okay, yeah. So let's call it the scalar function capital B, and then also then so sum of a gradient and a curl. And so I'll write this curl as b tilde, okay? Again, vector, okay? So this term, this gradient term, it has one scalar degree of freedom, right? This b is a scalar, okay? This b tilde, this has 2 degrees of freedom, right? It's a vector for which we've imposed one condition, i.e. that it has vanishing divergence, okay? Good. Right. So okay, good. So therefore in total this adds up to 1 plus 2 is 3 degrees of freedom in this vector B. Okay, so one scalar and 2 vector.
Can you say one more time why it has vanishing divergence?
Oh, so a curl has vanishing divergence.
Wait, why is this a curl?
So I'm decomposing this general 3-component vector into a sum of a gradient and a curl. And in general, I can decompose any vector that way, right? Yeah. Okay, good. I can similarly decompose this hij tensor also into scalars and vectors. Okay, so what are the what are the possible degrees of freedom, scalar degrees of freedom in H, for example? Okay. Well, so one obvious scalar degree of freedom in H is just its trace, okay? You know, so this H will clearly have a term that looks like, you know, something times just the Kronecker delta, right? The identity matrix, okay? But that isn't the, but that isn't the only possible scalar degree of freedom. Another possible scalar degree of freedom, that could show up is the second derivative of some scalar, okay? So also I can have things that look like grad I, grad j of some other scalar that I'll write as capital E. Okay. Note, however, so since we've already included a trace, okay? I have to therefore subtract off the trace of this to make this degree of freedom independent of this. Okay, so therefore I can write this as this thing minus the trace, which is just 1/3 delta ij Laplacian squared. Okay, so my tensor hij at least has two possible scalar degrees of freedom. I can also write a vector component to this hij, since in general it can have terms that look like the derivative of some vector. Okay, so terms that look like grad I, let's call it ej for some vector j. Okay, in general, this vector ej can also have gradient and curl components. Okay. But the gradient degree of freedom is already accounted for in this term, right? Okay. So therefore, the only leftover independent degrees of freedom are in the derivative of some vector with no divergence. Okay. And so, like before, I will denote vectors without a divergence, with these tildes. Okay. Also, finally, since this hij is a symmetric tensor, this also has to be symmetric, okay? And so therefore, I will symmetrize on the indices I and j. And you guys have seen that notation before, right? Okay, good. Good. So therefore, what do I have? So far I have 1, 2 scalar degrees of freedom, and then I have this divergenceless vector. I have two vector degrees of freedom. This hij, this symmetric matrix had 6 degrees of freedom initially. So therefore then I have at least 2 extra degrees of freedom whose behavior is independent of these previous degrees of freedom. Okay, and so I will write that as EIJ, again with tilde, okay? Where again, this tilde means that this tensor has no divergence on either index I or J. Okay, so therefore, for some arbitrary perturbation to the metric tensor, we have the following degrees of freedom.
Why do we want this one to be divergenceless?
Sorry?
Why do we want the tensor degrees of freedom to also be divergenceless?
Because again, if it has a divergence, it's already accounted
all
for.
The divergences are already.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Okay, good. So now let's just count up all of our possible degrees of freedom. Okay, so scalars. So we have A, B, this E, and this C. Okay, so we have 4 scalar degrees of freedom. Okay, for our vector degrees of freedom, we have this B tilde and also this E tilde. Okay, so B tilde, E tilde. And so in total, then how many vector degrees of freedom? Sorry? How many are there for each one of these? They're all spatial vectors with no divergence. Exactly. Each of these has 2. So in total I have 4 degrees of freedom. Okay. And here I have 2 degrees of freedom, right? Because again, this was 6 originally, and I counted for 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. So therefore I have 2 of these tensor degrees of freedom. Which you wrote as EIJ. Okay, and again, the entire reason to do this decomposition is that we'll see later on that the evolution equations for these scalars will be decoupled from these other vector and tensor modes. Okay, so what we'll find is that the evolution equations for this A, B, C, and E, they will depend on A, B, C, and E, but not on these B tilde, E tilde, et cetera. Okay. And similarly for the tensors, their equations of motion depend on the tensors and not on the vectors and scalars and so on. Okay. And so later on, so our lives will be easier having done this decomposition initially. Okay, good. So in total, we have, it looks like, 10 degrees of freedom, which makes sense, because a symmetric four-dimensional tensor H mu nu has to have 10 degrees of freedom in total. Okay. However, though, because of the coordinate freedom in general relativity, it turns out that not all of these, are in fact real dynamical, degrees of freedom. Okay. So instead, actually, some of these, turn out to be gauge artifacts. Okay. Yeah. So not all 10 are dynamical degrees of freedom. Okay, so to remind you what I mean by that, right, so we are free to change coordinates, right? So we're free to change from our coordinates x mu to some other x prime mu, right? Doing this coordinate change will then change the form of the metric, going from, g mu nu to some g prime. Okay, and this g prime, so for a small change to our coordinates, this G prime, similarly will be some small change to our initial metric, right? Okay. So this small change looks exactly like the perturbations that we are considering, right? Okay. So what this means is that therefore not all of these possible perturbations are real. Okay, so instead, some of them just, just correspond just to changing, changing our coordinate system. Okay, so since we have four coordinates, we therefore have, four of these gauge degrees of freedom in our metric. And it's easy to see what kind of degrees of freedom those are. Okay, so in general, we can write a transformation like this. So here, let's just write it out. So x0 initially and xi. Okay, and so a general transformation we can write as this goes to, let's say, x prime 0, x prime I, which is the initial x0 plus some scalar t, the initial xi plus some vector l, okay, for some scalar t and some vector l. This vector l I can similarly decompose into a gradient and a curl, okay? So therefore, then I have 1, 2 scalar degrees of freedom, and therefore 2 vector gauge degrees of freedom, okay? And so then going back to our table here, okay, the number of dynamical degrees of freedom we'll have is 4 minus our 2 gauge degrees of freedom. Let me erase. Okay. Similarly, we have these 4 vector degrees of freedom minus 2 gauge degrees of freedom. Okay, giving us 2, 2, and we can't gauge away these tensor degrees of freedom, so this stays as 2. Okay, and so in total we have 6 components, to our perturbations to the metric, corresponding to 2 scalar degrees of freedom, 2 vector perturbations, and 2 tensor perturbations. Okay, so these 2 scalar perturbations are really important because these we'll see, they couple to scalar density perturbations. Okay, and so therefore we will discuss these in great detail.
Sorry, I'm not sure I fully understood the parts of the gauge degrees of freedom. Okay, so the T and the L you introduced there.
It's just a change of coordinates that I'm free to do whatever I feel like, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So the gauge degrees of freedom came from those?
Well, so what I'm saying is that in this very general decomposition to my metric perturbations, okay, some of those apparent possible metric perturbations aren't really real, they just correspond just to changing coordinates. Yeah. And so what I'm saying is that, so you can, I mean, well, right, And so doing this argument, we can see that, you know, changing coordinates, corresponds to two scalar changes and also two of these divergenceless vector changes. Yeah, that's all I mean by that. Good. Okay, good. Yeah, anyway, okay, right, yes, okay, right. So these two scalar metric perturbations, they will be really important because, again, you know, just by Einstein's equations, they will couple to scalar density perturbations. And therefore, you know, they will be important for things like gravitational instability. Okay, these two tensor perturbations are also interesting. Okay, so this tensor Eij tilde, right, so it has no divergence on either spatial index, and therefore it is transverse, right? It's also traceless because we took away any possible trace. Okay, so therefore these are transverse traceless tensor modes. And what do we call transverse traceless tensor modes? Gravitational waves, exactly. Okay, good. So yeah, okay, right. So these are interesting because these two tensor degrees of freedom, they correspond to the two polarizations of gravitational waves. Okay, and so we'll see during our discussion of inflation that these sort of gravitational waves are generated quantum mechanically during inflation. But because they don't couple directly to scalar density perturbations, they do not grow over time, okay? And so therefore, their amplitude stays small throughout cosmic history. And so therefore, for now, I will neglect them, okay? So later on, we will add them back. But for now, because they are so small over all time compared to these scalar perturbations, for now, you know, so for now starting off, we will neglect them. These two... Yeah, so that's right. They don't grow in amplitude because they don't couple to scalar density perturbations, okay? So what I mean by that, you know, is that if we have some region which is overdense in mass, okay, you know, it'll generate a gravitational potential, gravitational accelerations that then cause more mass to fall into that region, making it deeper and deeper. And so therefore, these sort of perturbations can grow over time just by gravitational instability. Okay, these, however, do not grow over time. There's, I mean, right, like, you know, these ones are just propagating gravitational waves, right? And so for that reason, you know, even though initially the same quantum fluctuations generate these perturbations at the same time that, you know, I mean, early on during inflation, today these are much bigger in some sense than these because these have grown gravitationally. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, finally, the last two are the vectors. Okay, so you can show that actually these are not generated during inflation. And also you can show, so even if they were, generated, they decay over time. Okay, and so therefore, for that reason, I will also neglect these two possible vector degrees of freedom. Okay. So, good. So therefore, in total then, we're left with just these two scalar degrees of freedom that we'll start off with. Okay, and again, we are free to choose coordinates that will make these two degrees of freedom convenient to work with, okay? So for example, you know, in the literature, you'll often see this gauge choice called synchronous gauge, okay? And that choice just corresponds just to setting A equal to 0. So in this Dodelson book that I mentioned, okay, so he uses what's called conformal Newtonian gauge. And this gauge choice corresponds to setting B and E equal to 0, okay? And so therefore, A and C are non-zero. And so in this gauge, our metric takes the following form. So A squared and then minus 1 plus A, D eta squared. And then 1 plus C and then our spatial metric. Okay, and so this is the, okay, right, and so this is the metric that we'll work with. More conventionally, instead of A and C, the usual notation is instead to write this as 2 psi and 2 phi. Okay, and so, yeah.
We don't have any like a tensor gauge degrees of freedom. So it means that like whenever we're talking about tensor degrees of freedom, they should be physical.
That's right. That's right. They cannot be gauged away. That's right. Exactly.
Like, deeply, why is that the case?
Oh, well, right, yeah, so you saw that for a general coordinate transformation, right, it'll have one scalar and two scalar.
And if I wanted to construct some metric that can also have, like, tensor degrees of freedom, that gravitational wave just be, like, gauge artifacts, why do I need, what would I need to do that? Like,
you're asking, can I make spurious gravitational waves just by a poor choice of coordinates? No. So, you know, so that was this whole controversy, I guess, you know, dating back to Einstein when he first, you know, talked about gravitational waves. At first, I think people thought that they were just, coordinate, gauge artifacts, but no, right. So you can show that, and you know, so indeed these are actual physical degrees of freedom that propagate. Yeah.
For this specific metric, these are like for flat metric that we don't have any, we can see that gauge freedoms on the flat metric doesn't have any.
So perturbations around our chosen metric. Yeah, that's right. I guess what I'm saying is that more generally, that statement is more general.
Okay, so like we can prove for a more general class of metrics that we never can have tensor gauge degrees of freedom?
You can show that there are propagating gravitational waves that are not just gauge artifacts. Yeah. I don't know if that's your question. I don't know. Okay. Well, okay.
Yeah. My question is that, like, can we find any gauge? Like, where is the situation that I should be worried that, like, this specific tensor degrees of freedom, this specific propagation of, like, some tensor mode that I see, is not physical? That physical situation? Like,
well, right.
That situation, what kind of metric can...
Yeah, so one way, I guess, to think about it just is to try changing your, you know, changing your coordinates and then see if these tensor modes go away or not. Yeah, and so what I'm saying is that no matter what you do, you'll always be left over with these two possible tensor modes.
You cannot get through them.
Yeah, that's right. Again, you know, I mean, all right, you know, and so again, it's just a statement that gravitational waves are not just gauge artifacts. They cannot be gauged away. Yeah. Yeah.
These gauge choices are not a complete gauge fixing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Because we are just setting 1 degree of freedom away in the first case, and in the second one, we are setting away 2 degrees of freedom.
This is not complete. That's right. Okay. Right. I mean, right. Yeah, you know. So there is one additional gauge choice to make on top of this when you use a synchronous gauge. That's right. Okay, but this is complete because we have 2 degrees of freedom, right?
But in total, we have 4 coming from diffeomorphism.
We have 4.
We need to remove 4 degrees of freedom.
We're not fixing the vector gauge degrees of freedom.
So again, for now, I'm neglecting the tensor degrees of freedom. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've also fixed these to vanish.
They are always in our case.
I'm assuming that, these are vanished. That's right. Yeah. Okay. This is slower than I thought. Okay, good. Okay, anyway, yeah, so this phi and this psi, they are called the metric potentials. Okay. And the reason they're called that, you know, is that we'll see pretty soon, you know, so this phi and this psi, you know, their effect is very similar just to the, just the gravitational potential in just, you know, normal, Newtonian gravity. But I do want to make a note of the sign convention that I'm taking here. So for this choice of signs, okay, this psi will act like the Newtonian gravitational potential, at least on, you know, small scales that are small scales that are non-relativistic. This phi, however, will act like minus the Newtonian gravitational potential. Okay, let's just make note of that, because I think in GR, often the opposite sign choice is made for this piece. Oh yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't ask, because maybe it's too off topic. But I always forget, why is there like an intuitive way to see why it's commonly written with the two?
Oh yeah, because you want this in the non-relativistic limit to look like the Newtonian gravitational potential. Yeah. Okay, so for example, right, so you've seen so the Schwarzschild metric, right? You know, and so Schwarzschild, this piece looks like, plus or minus 2gm over r. And right, you know, so the Newtonian metric is gm over r, right? Yeah. Yeah, so it's similar to that. Okay. Good. Any other questions about this before we start using it? Okay, if not, then let's go through.
What happened to Vij tilde?
The tensor degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So for now, I'm assuming that these and these are negligible. Okay, later on, we will add this back in. But for now, I'm starting off with, just with only scalar degrees of freedom. Okay, for the reasons that I said before, which is that these grow over time, these do not grow over time, they just propagate, yeah. Okay, so let's, maybe I'll leave that up. Okay, so now to give you a sense of how these things work, let's just go through one example of using these metrics. Okay, and so the example that we'll go through is to compute the time evolution of the energy of some particle propagating in this metric. Okay, so the example will be some particle's energy. Okay, so working this out will take some time. I think we might not finish today, given how slow I'm going. But I think it's important, for you guys to see this sort of calculation at least like one time. Okay, so the first thing we have to do is to define what we mean by energy. Okay, so for a smooth universe, the energy, just meant the time component of the momentum four vector, right? But now that we have perturbations, that definition becomes a bit ambiguous. So what I'll do is to follow Dodelson's definitions. Okay, so what he does is a bit unusual, but I'll follow it here. Okay, so first what he does is to change variables from the four momentum p, okay, instead to the following four variables. So call it e, p, and p hat. Okay, so what are these? So this scalar p is related to the momentum four vector the following way. So this p squared is just, the norm of the spatial part of the four momentum. Okay, so it's gij, pi, pj. This p hat he defines as a unit vector pointing in the same direction as the spatial part of the four momentum. Okay, so that is, we can write pi as, just some constant times pi hat. Okay. Where again, this is a unit vector, and so therefore, delta ij, p hat I, p hat j, is equal to 1. Okay, so we can solve for this, for this constant of, for the constant of proportionality, just by using our definition of this scalar p. Okay, so this gij, pi, pj. Okay, so now if we insert our expression for the metric, this is a squared 1 plus 2 phi delta ij. Okay, so that was gij, and then we have then now inserting for pi c squared pi hat pj hat. Okay, and so this is just one, right? This is one, leaving us with c squared a squared 1 plus 2 phi. Okay, and all this equals p squared. So therefore, so our constant of, so our constant of proportionality is just p over a 1 minus phi. Okay, to lowest order. Okay, right. So yeah, so to be clear, okay, so here and also now throughout, okay, we'll be using the fact that phi and psi are both small, and therefore we will work only to lowest order in phi and psi. Okay, and then finally, he defines this E, the energy E, as E squared is P squared plus M squared. Okay, so I want you to note that this E is not the same as the time component of the four momentum. Okay, but they are related to each other the norm of, the norm of the four vectors, so G mu nu, P mu, P nu, which is minus M squared, is, okay, let me write this out. So this is GTT PT squared plus GIJ PI PJ. Okay, the time part of the metric is minus 1 plus 2 psi, and then pt squared, and this gij pij pj was just p squared. Okay, so all of this equals minus m squared. Okay, so therefore we can see then that the energy E, I'll just write it up here. Okay, so the energy E becomes to lowest order 1 plus psi times the time part of the four momentum.
Is times not a conformal time?
No. Okay, sorry. These t's are not conformal time. They are the proper time.
So why we don't have any a as a coefficient of 1 plus
t? Yeah, exactly. Right. If I had used p eta instead of pt, there would be a's floating around.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Right. Okay, good. Glad that you are paying attention. Okay. Okay, good. So now what we'll do is, is to use these coordinates, okay, this E, P, and P hat instead of the, P mu's, to describe our particles. Okay, so now with those definitions, let's compute how the energy changes as the particle propagates freely. Okay, so let me erase this now. Okay, good. So right. Okay, yeah. So as I said, okay, yeah. So so let's compute how this quantity E changes as a particle moves freely. And by moving freely, what I mean, is a particle that follows a geodesic. Okay. So yeah. So now, okay. Yeah. So now what we'll do is to compute dE dt. For a particle moving on a geodesic. Okay, so good. So now plugging in our expression for E, you can see that this is d by dt of 1 plus psi times the time part of the four momentum, okay, which is d psi dt times pt plus 1 plus psi times d pt dt. Okay, so now I want to be clear. All of these time derivatives, these mean derivatives, derivatives along the geodesic. Okay, So that means time derivatives, that are co-moving with this particle. Okay, these are also called convective derivatives, co-moving derivatives, so on. Okay. Good. So the important thing is that we can work out these sort of convective derivatives just by using the geodesic equation. Okay, and so to remind you, the geodesic, geodesics satisfy d by d tau of the four velocity vanishes, right? Where this tau corresponds to proper time along the geodesic, and u is the four velocity, okay? The four velocity is related to the four momentum just by p mu is m u mu. So I'll call it alpha just to distinguish from m. Okay, so if we multiply this by m, we get that d by d tau of p alpha vanishes. Okay, so we want the time derivative, we want the derivative with respect to coordinate time, not with respect to the proper time tau. But those are related, of course, because dp alpha dt is dp alpha d tau divided by dt d tau. And of course, that's just, dp alpha d tau divided by the time component of the four velocity. Okay? Good. The numerator here, this dp alpha d tau, this is a covariant derivative, right? So this dp alpha d tau is written out in coordinates, just means, u dot radiant of p, alpha component of that. Here, I'll write this as vector, as a vector statement, okay? Pushing components, just means u mu gradient. Oh, all right, this is up and this is down. P alpha is equal to zero, okay? So since this p is a vector, this covariant derivative, of course, involves the Christoffel symbols, right? So all of this is u mu partial mu p alpha plus gamma alpha mu nu p nu. Yes. Okay, so all this equals zero. Okay, and so therefore I can just move this over to this side. Okay, so therefore this minus u mu. This equals minus this. Is that too messy, or can you guys follow that? Should I rewrite it? Okay, hopefully you can follow that. Okay, good. So therefore, along the geodesic, okay, this expression then reduces to what I wrote there. So it's minus gamma alpha mu nu p nu u mu over ut. Okay, and then if I multiply top and bottom by m, and these u's just turn into p's, okay? Okay, good. And so this statement is true in general, for geodesics, even for null geodesics like photons. Okay, good. So now let's plug in this expression for dp alpha dt into our expression here, where we have this dp dt entering, okay? So then this becomes what I wrote, so d psi dt pt plus 1 plus psi. And now all of this, okay, so it's minus gamma t mu nu p mu p nu over pt. Okay, good. Right. Okay, good. Now, similarly for this first term, we also want to work out the convective derivative along the geodesic of psi, the metric potential. Okay, so then let's work that out. Okay, so d psi dt is partial psi partial t plus d psi dxi dxi dt. Okay, where again this xi corresponds to position along the particle's motion. Okay, this last term is dxi dt. That's related to the particle's momentum because, of course, dxi dt, this is just ui divided by ut, which is pi divided by pt. Okay, good. So good. So right. So if we plug in our definitions of pi and pt in terms of our variables e, p, and p hat, okay, what we get is that this becomes p hat I over ae 1 minus phi 1 plus psi. Okay, good. And so now we can then insert this into our expression here for dx dt. Okay? And so doing that, we get that this is partial psi partial t plus d psi dxi p hat I over AE. Okay? Everyone with me?
I have a doubt about that. Like, the partial derivative of V with respect to tau, it's the total, it's a total derivative of V with respect to tau, which should be zero because that's the geodesic equation.
Say it again.
The numerator in that expression, dp alpha d tau, shouldn't that be zero? Because we have, like, that is the geodesic equation.
Maybe I've been sloppy in terms of my total and partial derivatives.
Should be partial somewhere.
Let me just verify that. But it's likely that I've been sloppy in my notation. Did you have a question or?
Why you don't have those 1 minus phi and 1 plus psi up?
These terms.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. So why not?
No. I mean, like, why you don't? You didn't write them.
Yeah, exactly.
But still, you can have a term over there of 1 minus phi plus psi.
I sure can. And so, good. And so then why didn't I write them up there?
It's the opposite of psi.
Sorry?
They're not assuming, you're assuming that phi is equal to psi?
Oh, well, I didn't assume that. I mean, yeah, I mean, right, that's true, but... but that is not the reason why I didn't write them. Yeah.
Obviously, they have opposite signs.
Okay. No. Yeah. That isn't the reason. Okay. Good. So, what is this multiplying up here? It's multiplying this term. And this is already first order in the perturbations. So therefore, I keep only the zeroth order part of that term. Okay. So again. That sort of reasoning will happen throughout. Okay, good. We are almost out of time. Okay, good. So then the next thing.
We are still waiting for you to come back to the along the geodesic. Like it's zero, but not zero question.
Right. So as I said, let me just check afterwards about my notation. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay, so where was I? Okay, good. So now we can plug this into our expression for dE dt. Okay, so let me write that out as well. Okay, so then, right, so then plugging this into our expression for dE dt, what we get is dE dt is, and then we had a pt multiplying d psi dt. And then here is our d psi dt, right, which was partial. Plus d psi dx p hat I over AE minus 1 plus psi gamma t mu nu of p mu p nu over pt. Okay, next what I'll do is to replace this PT using our definition of the energy E, which was E was equal to 1 plus psi PT. Okay, and so therefore doing that here, I just get E here. Okay, so again, everyone sees why? Good. Okay, so now the last term then, so now the last thing to do now is to expand this out. Okay, so that involves replacing P mu, P nu, and PT with E, P, and P hats, and also then plugging in expressions for the Christoffel symbols. In the interest of time, let me just skip through most of that. Let me just give you the important pieces that you need to do it yourself. So the relevant Christoffel symbols are gamma t tt is d psi dt. Gamma t ti is d psi dxi. And gamma tij is a squared multiplied by h 1 minus 2 psi minus plus 2 phi plus d phi dt. All this times Kronecker delta ij. Okay, and then we'll use the expressions for pt, pi, pj in terms of our variables e, p, and p hat. So just to remind you, those were that PT was 1 minus psi times energy E, and PI was 1 minus phi over A P hat. Okay, and so now it's just algebra, inserting all of these into these terms here. And then I will skip over that algebra. It turns out that a huge cancellation of terms arises. If we work to first order, what we get is the following expression that we'll stop with, which is the following. Okay, so dE dt will work out to minus P hat I over A d psi dxi minus P squared over E H plus d phi dt. Okay, so let me just spend a minute talking about that expression. So here I'll just erase the rest of this for clarity. Okay, so have people caught up to that? Let me know when you're ready. Okay, so people have caught up? Okay, good. Right, so okay, so let's try and interpret this expression. Okay, so first let's compare this to our previous result, for a smooth universe, right? So previously, we had found that momenta just redshift as the universe expands, right? This term gives us exactly that behavior. Okay, so this term with the Hubble constant, okay, that term gives us exactly that behavior. If you want, I can show you how, or do you guys see that? Okay. Right. So, okay. So, dE dt I can write as dE dp multiplied by dp dt. Right? We had previously gotten an expression for this. dP dt was minus hp, right? And dE dP is P over E. So I get dE dT is minus P squared over E times H. Okay, good. So this term just corresponds just to redshifting as universe expands. Okay, the same thing we had seen before for our smooth unperturbed universe. But now we have some other terms as well. Okay, so this first term here on the right, this should also look kind of familiar. Right? So if we think of this psi as being the Newtonian gravitational potential, okay, then this d by dx is a derivative, a spatial derivative, like the gradient of psi. X was a co-moving coordinate, but this 1 over a d by dx is therefore a proper physical gradient. Okay, so therefore this is the gradient of psi minus the gradient of psi, right? And and of course the gradient of the Newtonian potential is just the gravitational acceleration, right? That's dotted into p p hat, which is the momentum vector, right? So this term just looks like, so momentum is mass times velocity, right? So mass times acceleration is the gravitational force, force dotted into velocity, okay? And of course, that's just, the work being done on the particle, right? Okay, so this term just corresponds just to the work done on the particle due to falling down some gravitational potential. Okay, good. This last term, this d phi dt, this also has a simple interpretation. Okay, so the idea is just that, just that if some particle is sitting in some gravitational potential, if that potential gets deeper over time, the particle's energy has to change over time as well. Okay? Good. So therefore, hopefully all of these terms make sense. The nice thing is that we derived this fully relativistically, and therefore we got some practice using the machinery of perturbation theory. Okay. Now the reason why I went through all that work, to derive this expression is that this will appear in the next thing we discuss next time, which is the perturbed Boltzmann equation. Okay, so far we talked about the metric perturbations, and so next time we're going to talk about now the perturbations to the matter fields, and our starting point there will be the perturbed version of the Boltzmann equation that we talked about before. Okay, so sorry for going late, but we'll stop here for now, and the next time we'll get next time we'll start this. Okay, so thanks.
Assume the homework you sent me on this perturbed Boltzmann equation would be a very good tutorial for them to do others.
Yeah, no.